Welcome to Podcast Against Antisemitism, the show that takes a deep dive into the world's oldest hatred. I'm Ellie, your host, and you can join us for new episodes every Thursday. Subscribe now at antisemitism.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss a show. You can also watch the podcast on our YouTube channel. And please consider leaving us a nice review so we can grow our listenership. It makes a big difference. My guest today is Susanna Fogel, the executive producer and multi-episode director of the biographical drama A Small Light, a mini-series that takes a look at the remarkable real-life heroism of Miep Gies, the woman responsible for hiding Anne Frank's family, the Van Pels family, and Fritz Pfeffer during the Holocaust. The miniseries, which stars Belle Powley as Miep Gies and Liev Schreiber as Otto Frank, is produced by ABC Signature and Keshet Studios for National Geographic and is available to stream exclusively on Disney+. Susanna, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing great. Thank you.
So I watched this all of the episodes, as I mentioned to you. I really enjoyed it. And Miep Gies may be a name that not many people have heard of. Of course, pretty much everyone knows Anne Frank. But what is the story of the miniseries and what inspired it?
Basically, Joan Rader and Tony Phelan, who are the creators and writers of the show, had become obsessed with the story of this young woman in her 20s and 30s who was living in Amsterdam, an immigrant from Vienna. She had been raised Catholic, but was agnostic and not particularly religious. She was sort of a regular 20-something girl dealing with regular 20-something issues. She had a new marriage. She couldn't get a job. She liked to go out and drink too much with her best friend. And you know, finally, she managed to score a job, and she was working for a company that made pectin, which is the ingredient that thickens jam. And her boss at her one job that would employ her was Otto Frank, a very famous Jewish figure, father of the canonical hero Anne Frank. Miep was thrust into a situation where her boss, just a regular person in her life, asked her to hide his family when the Nazis occupied Holland. So basically, Miep was the regular person put in a situation where she had to make a choice to say yes or say no to this thing. And her instinct was to say yes. And then it led to a cavalcade of other decisions that she didn't really think about, but that sort of followed from there. And it's a coming of age story about Miep. So it's a long way of saying that that's what the story is about. It's about this regular 20-something girl who is put to an extraordinary test. But I became involved when Joan and Tony, who had worked on researching her and really getting to know her story for years, approached me to help develop the script and then, direct the series with them. And I was somewhat aware of Miep just by name because I grew up Jewish, although not particularly observant. No offense to any listeners of this podcast. Like, I do Passover, but that's about it. But my mother had spent some time in Amsterdam, so I'd been there a couple times, and I just knew Miep's name, but not much else. And when I was a kid, Miep was an old lady in my mind, you know? And then as I got to be older, I realized, and past the age that Miep was at the time that she did the thing she did, I had a whole new understanding of what she did. I was like, oh, this is just a young woman. You know, this is just a person who, you know, in today's unoccupied America would be like, you know, on Instagram and figuring shit out and dating the wrong guys and, you know.
Yeah.
And here she is asking incredible things. But the way that she approaches it and what really drew me to it was it's so human. She does things and then she questions her decisions. She's insecure about certain things. There's moments when in her deepest, darkest thoughts, she wishes she didn't have this responsibility. So I feel like it gives people an avatar for their own experience. That's not some like exalted heroic figure that is more virtuous than you could ever be. It's just a person trying to figure out how to do the right thing, but also just acting from her heart and her humanity and then dealing with the consequences of that.
Right. And I like that one thing the series does is they do show Meep as a human. Like, she is flawed. She isn't perfect, which I thought was really, really good. And you mentioned that this all started when Otto Frank, her employer, made this request of her. But what was the relationship between Meep and Otto and the rest of the Franks like? Because I know he was her employer, but there was more to it than that.
Yeah, I mean, it began as sort of, you know, she didn't know what she was doing and she wasn't a particularly good assistant. But over time, over a couple of years, she got to know him and got to know the family, and they really connected on the fact that they were both immigrants to Holland. And she had left her family and been adopted by a Dutch family because there was sort of a scarcity of resources in Vienna. Mother didn't have any money, single mother. So she sent her to this foster family, essentially. And so Meep and Otto really connected on that level. And Meep also not having her family in Amsterdam kind of became absorbed and found a surrogate family in the Franks. And so, you know, Meep was like a big sister to Anne and Margot. She was, you know, helpful to the family in a lot of ways. And they gave her a sense of family and community. So they were friends, I would say, as well, by the time he asked her to hide the family. And of course, they became a lot closer during the time that she was responsible for them in the annex too.
Yeah. Now, when Otto Frank asked Meep to hide him and his family, they both knew that this was dangerous for all involved. What were the risks that Meep ran in doing this?
I mean, there were a lot of risks, from small to matters of life and death. You know, I mean, this was a time that people were being shot for less. You know, there's a moment in the pilot where Meep and her best friend walk by an ice cream store, and you know, the Jews were supposed to go to different ice cream shops, and everything was being segregated in that way. And an ice cream store owner was selling ice cream to Jews against the orders of the Nazis and was shot in the street. So that happens in the pilot. It's like things were really extreme, and there was a lot of erratic enforcement of the Germans' agenda at the time. So it could have been anything. I mean, she could have been caught and shot if a guard was having a bad day, you know? So it was, those stakes were really high for her. But also it was sort of for a period of 2 years, it was like there was constant risk. I mean, not just people seeing the Franks actually in the annex, but also the idea that Meep was getting food for so many people every day. She had to go to like 5 different grocery stores to get 5 different, you know, bundles of carrots because someone would be suspicious if she got too many. So it was just a constant risk everywhere. And then getting ration books, she and Jan, her husband, who worked for the social work bureau, he had to sort of essentially lie to get ration cards for people that, you know, he couldn't admit who they were really for. So he had to make up people and go to his boss and say, oh, there's this woman and she can't come in herself. And so this very kind of just like regular couple had to sort of become spies in their own way, which is really interesting.
Yeah, and it's kind of remarkable that Meep said yes when so many other people would have said no. I mean, you mentioned the scene earlier with the ice cream shop. I think, if I remember, she's with her friend and Meep is kind of shocked and she goes, can you believe this? And her friend kind of brushes it off and it's kind of this, like, well, the Jews have their own place to go. Given that so many people at the time wouldn't have done this, what was it about Meep that made her say yes?
You know, it's funny, Meep herself had a very optimistic view of human nature in spite of everything. And the title of the show comes from this quotation that she had where she said, I'm not a hero, anyone can do what I did, basically. She said, even an ordinary housewife, secretary, or teenager can turn on a small light in a dark room. So basically, she didn't think that she was that extraordinary. We see her as extraordinary because I think we see so many people in the world either being complicit actively or passively by just not taking action when things are unjust around them, and they always are. But Meep herself kind of believed that this is just what anybody would do, which I think speaks to her like complete optimism about human nature. But yeah, I mean, I think what made her do it was just her sense of empathy and just her sense of love. I don't think it was some idea of becoming a hero or some overly altruistic, you know, saintliness or anything. I think she just was a person who I think, first of all, she said yes in a moment of impulsiveness. She didn't necessarily think about all of the she didn't know the war was going to go on as long as it did. She didn't know it would be 2 years. It's kind of like when anything happens in our modern world, it's like when we thought COVID would be 2 weeks and then it's still going on, you know? It's like, okay, yeah, I can do this for a while. They'll be gone soon. And then it just proceeds and proceeds and proceeds. And then 2 years later, she's been doing this and this is her new normal. But she didn't know the magnitude of what she was taking on at the time, in a way. So I think that it was just that moment, just that turning point moment of, yeah, of course I'm going to do this because that's who she is. And the magnitude of it revealed itself only afterwards, I think, to her.
Right, right. And you mentioned before that the story also looks at her husband, Jan, who was an activist in the Dutch resistance against the Nazis. And he also goes on a bit of his own journey there. Can you tell us a bit about Jan and what he was up to?
Yeah. So Jan was Miep's husband. We see them kind of meeting and falling in love in the pilot and being a new couple. And Jan was always, you know, he was sort of more of a beta male, more of a put your head down and do the work and have quiet strength and integrity, but don't sort of make a scene. And Miep was definitely a make a scene kind of person. She was like 5 foot tall Spitfire, and her big challenge was to be less conspicuous. And his challenge in his life was always to be more conspicuous. And I think that that's what made them a great couple in the end. But Jan was working for the social. Jan was a social worker, so he always had the desire to help people in a bureaucratic way, if not a radical way, and that actually positioned him perfectly to be helpful in this subversive thing that they were doing, because he did have access to ration books and he could kind of get resources. He had to lie. He had to like violate the rules of his job to do it, but he did that, and took those little risks and. And with Miep's urging kind of became more radical in his own way. And then you'll see in the series that like, as he starts doing things of greater risk, using work and the resources of work, he ends up keeping some secrets from Miep because to reveal them would be to put her at risk. So then you have this couple like lying to each other too. And that is complicated for their relationship. And it like puts some very real strains on their relationship, even though they're both doing what's right. But anyway, you know, Miep and Jan they're just like a good yin and yang. You know, Jan's journey is one of like, he knows what the right thing to do is ideologically, but it's a challenge for him to stand up and do radical things because he's not like a radical personality type, you know, in the beginning. Like yeah. More of a passive guy who finds his strength through this. And Miep is a kind of an all over the place, disorganized, hot mess who has to become a little bit more of a grown up. So that's the sort of arc of these two characters in the show.
Yeah, well, look, they have a great dynamic, I think. And so talking about the people who they were hiding now, most people will have certainly heard of Anne Frank, if not the Frank family, her father Otto, her sister Margot, and her mother Edith. But not everyone will have heard of the other people hiding alongside them in the secret annex. Who were the other people hiding with them? And what do we know about their relationship with Miep?
Well, some of the people they were hiding, and the truth is that Miep and Jan were also hiding and helping families around the city. So it wasn't just this group of people, but the people that are in the show, the Van Pels family, I think people will know because they'll remember Peter Van Pels as Anne Frank's crush in the diary. But the Van Pelses were friends of the Franks. They were, you know, Otto Frank made jam at his company with Pectin, and Van Pels made a spice blend for sausages. So they kind of went into business together. And the Van Pelses were other immigrants from Germany that were best friends with the Franks. So just the Franks' friends, basically. And then Fritz Pfeffer was Miep's dentist. So also somebody that the Franks had actually introduced Miep to him as her dentist. And, you know, we'll see that he was like pulling her teeth as he was also asking her this. And she had to make this decision. Like, I don't really know my dentist. It's my dentist. He's not my best friend, but he's a person and he needs help and he's a good guy and he's a good dentist. And how can I say no to this guy? So it's sort of like the slippery slope. Once she says yes, she can't help but have a broken heart whenever she sees people that need her. And the people that need her happen to be just ordinary people in a 20-something's life, like your dentist and your boss, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And what about the relationship with each other? Because there are a couple scenes where we can see that they're kind of getting on each other's nerves.
Yeah. You mean within the Frank family or just everybody else?
Everyone in the annex, you know, Dr. Pfeffer is getting on Anne's nerves and vice versa and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, one thing the show tries to do, and I think the reason to tell it from Meep's perspective and not another installment of a story from Anne's perspective, is really that we get to see a little bit more of the messy humanity of it. And it doesn't feel like we're like defaming historical icon because Meep is a little more anonymous in the world. So we get to kind of go into it from the side, like, okay, what's the toll this is taking on Meep's marriage? Let's watch Meep, you know, have some character flaws. Whereas if we were doing a story about Anne, it would feel a little bit blasphemous or random to be like, now let's look at this annoying 14-year-old. You know, like we wouldn't really, there's no reason for that. It sort of feels more problematic. But for Meep, you get to see her flaws and we also get to kind of, yeah, you get to take a more holistic view of what was going on up there, which is that it's a bunch of adults and kids jammed into a small space for years, you know, teenagers who want nothing but like distance from their parents have to be in the same room with their parents all day long. And, you know, I think that was a big part of it too. It's like the teen angst was like palpable in there, you know? And then just the personalities, you know, Mrs. Van Pels was sort of fancy and Mrs. Frank was sort of thought that she had like a lot of pretensions and just personality clashes, people that you can have dinner with once a month at a dinner party, but you don't want to live in one room with them, you know, all day for years.
So showing
all that, I think, was just the real logistical annoyances of all of that. And yes, it's a matter of life and death, but they weren't playing the stakes of that every day because they weren't aware of what the stakes really were. I mean, it was a really bizarre situation they were in and they were terrified, but at the same time, they didn't know how the story was going to end.
Hey, if you want to stay up to date with the fight against anti-Semitism, why not subscribe to Campaign Against Anti-Semitism? Visit antisemitism.org/act or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube. Let me ask you about the actual making of the show, because when dealing with such heavy subject matter, what sort of preparations must those involved undertake? Because of course, actors have to learn lines for a story, but as dark as this one, it feels like there might be more work to do, if you get me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the work that we did, that each of us did on our own, I think that the process of sort of understanding what these people went through, the stakes of what they did, reading books about them, you know, visiting the Terezin concentration camp, which was near where we were filming in Prague, like all of these things that people did, or even retracing Meep's steps, the things that Belle did and the rest of the actors did, those were sort of, I think the actors really undertook those types of preparation, like in a solitary way. It's a very personal, solitary thing that everybody kind of did in their independent study way. Like the thing that they did alone was do all of the research about the tragedy of it all. And then the thing that we did together, you know, well, recommending books and recommending things to each other, but that was sort of the homework assignment to get there and start working together. When we were together, we really focused on building those relationships in every other way. Like, what is the human bond between these people, and developing the kind of like the humanity and the warmth and the light and the humor. That's the thing that we worked on as a group, because that's the thing that we really wanted to make sure was really coming through in the show, and was a really strong layer. But you know, there are books, there are films, that we sort of had a reading list and a watch list that we sent around for everyone.
Yeah. Nice. And when filming the show, what was the general feeling on set?
You know, any set is very technical and logistical. As much as watching something is really immersive and emotional, when you're actually filming something, you know, you have to do it 28 times and you have 1,000 people standing around with equipment that are like wearing shorts, and you know, it's not it's like yeah. everybody is like dressed in period costumes and that we're really in Amsterdam in the 40s, like living this. You know, the truth is that we all kind of became a family on the set. Everybody got along really well. We would spend time together when we were, when people were waiting to film and they were, you know, off on the sidelines or whatever, we would really spend time just together. You know, we would just kind of pass the time. I think we were trying to, there was a certain amount of just living in this world is so dark that we had to kind of find the moments of levity in the day. You know, whether that was like doing a crossword puzzle or gossiping or talking or laughing about some stupid thing, like memes, you know, it was like, you have to do the thing that, and honestly, that's in their 1940s way. That's what everyone was doing in the annex too. You know, I mean, they were reading books, they were escaping, they were getting each other on each other's nerves. They were gossiping about each other, you know? So yeah, I mean, we were kind of just, we frequently had moments of forgetting, you know, we weren't always, didn't always have the drama dialed up to a 10 off camera, because I think you can't, you know, and I know that Anne too, you know, she compartmentalized a bit. She had a crush. She like dreamed about becoming a movie star. You know, she had a lot of other thoughts. So anyway, I guess it wasn't like we were all sitting around soberly weeping on the sidelines. We were sort of like just being a family and being communal in that way. I think supporting each other through this, knowing that we were going to have something that was really kind of tragic to say, you know.
Sure, sure. But in a way, that's quite you know, lovely to hear that there was a camaraderie. Yeah. What are you hoping that viewers take away from the series, especially viewers who may not really know that much about the Holocaust?
You know, I think that a big point of the series is to just keep telling that story so that we can't forget it. I mean, I think if you're Jewish, you can't forget it anyway, because it is constantly part of your upbringing and your historical knowledge of yourself, and probably your family's traditions have some touched that in some way, and your family's like story. But I think for so many people, especially in a moment when like America's banning books and about not, it's like the Diary of Anne Frank was something that we all read in school when I was growing up. But now I know that that's not the case, and a lot of people don't know, or people come to the Anne Frank house and don't know who she was now. We were told by the people at the Anne Frank house, so there are a lot of people that walk in and don't know the story.
Oh my gosh.
It's like we have this responsibility to, and if the responsibility is an entertaining, immersive miniseries, that's fine. It's still just telling that story and making sure that people know that it happened, so that they can't deny that it happened. But yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that people take away, one, that they just become aware of what happened, whatever that means to them, whatever the stakes of a humanitarian crisis that's happening anywhere for any reason. It's just, I think people should just know that they can do incredible things, you know, too. Anyone can. You can be just a party girl in your 20s and do a thing and change people's lives forever. We all can do that. I think there's a sense of like powerlessness now with young people. I feel like I'm 100 years old, but I'm like young people, but I feel like with all people really, but especially, but I, you know, you see it, it's like we have the option to be completely distracted all the time between our phones and our lives and the, you know, careerism of people in a lot of Western countries. You know, it's like, I think it's really, you know, we just want to wake people up and make them think about things and make them be alert and look up from whatever they're doing and just look around and see, you know, is there a way that they can do something so small that costs them nothing or costs them a lot, you know, that's incredible. Doing something instead of not doing something is sort of the moral of the story ultimately, you know?
Well, I think that's a really poignant moral, and one we need now more than ever, as we have seen that anti-Semitism levels are unfortunately rising. You know, following the Holocaust, I think there seemed to be this general feeling that anti-Semitism was finally considered unacceptable within society. But we are once again seeing a rise in anti-Semitism, with recent statistics showing that in the United States, anti-Semitism is at the highest level it has been in over 40 years. What do you make of anti-Semitism levels today, and are you surprised?
I am surprised. I guess when you grow up Jewish, you're sort of always aware that anti-Semitism is like a concept that exists, even though I think growing up in the 80s and 90s, it just was not a thing that, you know, I grew up in in New England where I was definitely in the minority, but there were other Jewish kids and it just wasn't really a thing. And then everybody is reading the Diary of Anne Frank and everybody is looking at the atrocities of the Holocaust. And it's just, it seems so completely shocking that that happened even within the century that we were still living in, you know, or at all. Just the idea that that would still be a thing is shocking, just on some conceptual level. But yeah, I mean, I am surprised, but maybe that makes me really naive. I think that there are certain, my best friend is Jewish and she grew up feeling a lot more of it where she was from. And she's sort of always said, well, no, I'm not surprised. This was always going to happen. Everyone's always had this. This has always been the undercurrent in culture. And I just haven't felt that in the same way that she has. So I think it varies. It varies among my friends too, but yeah, I mean, I am surprised about it. It's sort of like, how is this still a thing? Why are we still talking about this? This is a concept. This is a thought people have. I mean, I'm also, I think, privileged in the sense that I grew up with a liberal, really liberal family, and then lived in liberal communities like New York City and, you know, LA and places where I have a lot of Jewish friends and we're all kind of, none of us have had brushes with it that feel really dangerous or toxic, in that way. But now I think it's scary. I mean, now we're noticing it and it's sort of shocking. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, when the president of the United States, has to say, public service announcement, the Holocaust was real, it definitely happened. I think that's kind of a worrying time. And I kind of think that series like A Small Light, like you say, it's about keep telling that story. And it's kind of crazy that we have to say, just a reminder, this definitely happened, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the scariest part is that, you know, the last survivors of the Holocaust who were there to tell the tale they're getting older. And you know, it's sort of going to be up to us to tell that story, but there's no one to sort of have been a witness to it. Like at some point there won't be any witnesses left. And that's the scariest thing to me, just because we can sort of in this era of facts being considered opinions, and facts being considered subjective when they're not, you know, there are a lot of things that are subjective, but certain historical events are objective realities. And I think it's hard to think that that could be at risk is shocking, but also that's kind of how we talk about news these days. And everything is so politicized and partisan that even something like, no, this happened. Think a variety of things, but this did happen. If that's being questioned, it's like, what is stable? Like, if everything is up for debate, I don't know how we move forward, really, you know?
Yeah, totally. Now, as we begin to wrap up, I want to ask you a question that I ask all of our guests, which is, if someone who is not Jewish wants to help in the fight against anti-Semitism, where should they start?
That is a really good question. Where should they start? I mean, I think there are so many ways that people can contribute positively. So it really depends on the person, you know. I think that if you're a creative person and a storyteller, participating in projects where you're telling a story that in some way is progressive or telling tales like this, this is a way you can contribute, you know, just contributing to this, the sort of the canon of entertainment that is making this be sort of widely seen and acknowledged. So I think creative people can collaborate with people that are telling stories about, you know, people like me or people like Anne Frank. You know, I think that that's an important thing you can do. I don't know. I mean, that's a really open-ended question. I'm trying to say something that applies to all people. I would say, whatever role activism takes in an individual's life, whether that's through, you know, showing up and volunteering in some sort of a volunteer situation, or whether it's just, you know, something really, you don't have to have like money to donate. You know, you don't have to be in the entertainment industry with the power to make a meaningful television show about Anne Frank. You just have to show up in some way. I mean, if we're taking Meep at her word that everyone can turn on a small light, what is the small light to you? It really varies. For somebody, it's just going to be, a grand gesture. For another person, it's just going to be, you know, participating in some smaller way. If there's some sort of a small act of terrorism, like I know that where I live in LA, there was some vandalism at a temple a block away, and, you know, just showing up to help people clean up, you know, just being there in smallest ways. If you see some sort of incident, just showing up for an hour is meaningful, you know? Mm. So it can be that small, or it can be as big as, you know, if you are a billionaire, give some money to some organizations, you know?
Yeah, totally. You mentioned volunteering. Yeah. At this point, I want to say if people want to volunteer with us, we would absolutely love that. Go to antisemitism.org/volunteer. Susanna, before we finish, please tell the listeners, what have you got going on? What have you got coming up? And where can people find you?
People can find me. Well, I am having some problems with my Instagram because I got a new phone and I had 2-factor and it didn't transfer over. And now I can't get into Instagram. And no matter how many times I send them pictures and videos of myself saying that I am Susanna Fogel, they say we have no evidence of that. So,
classic.
I've decided that it's probably totally fine for me to not be on Instagram, but, let's see. I am on Twitter, and I will one day be on Instagram again, and I'm on Facebook because I'm, you know, a millennial or millennial Gen X cusp. So of course I'm on Facebook. I'm not hard to find. I'm around. I would say Twitter is a good way to find me. Let's see. What do I have going on? Well, I have a lot coming up actually. I directed the adaptation of a short story called Cat Person, which was a viral New Yorker story, which we premiered at Sundance and will be coming out the next year worldwide. That's a film. And I am finishing up a film now in New York about Reality Winner, who's a whistleblower who served the longest sentence for a single leaked document in the history of the country under the Espionage Act. But she was also, similar to Meep, she was a 20-something, she decided to say something when she saw something, and for that she was punished massively by the country. And so we're telling her story. So yeah, it's a coming of age movie with like a family story and heart and humanity and comedy, but it gets at something that's sort of damaged about our political system. So it's similar to Small Light in that way. That's called Winner. It's Amelia Jones from CODA is the star of that, and Connie Britton and Zach Galifianakis play the parents. And anyway, that's a really fun movie that should be coming out in the next year or so too. And then I have a couple other things in the pipeline, but those are the projects that I'm waiting for the world to see. They're done.
Nice. Nice. All right. Well, look, Susanna Fogel, thank you so much for coming on Podcast Against Antisemitism.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to listen to your back catalog of podcast recordings now that I know about you.
Oh, wonderful plug. Thank you. Always appreciate it. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Podcast Against Antisemitism. If you did, please subscribe and leave us a nice rating, or email any feedback to podcast@antisemitism.org. Until next Thursday, stay safe.